Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a June 2009 speech, President Obama said that solving our nation's challenges must begin at the community level.
So if anyone out there is waiting for government to solve all their problems, they're going to be disappointed. Because ultimately, the best solutions don't come from the top down, not from Washington. They come from the bottom up in each and every one of our communities.
Nonprofits from religious to secular address needs that otherwise go unmet, but how much more can they take of this economic downturn? Today we'll talk about the future of nonprofits and their ability to survive the times. Later on we'll hear from Columbus Business First columnist Alan Proctor and Nicole Edwards of the Edwards Group. First, we welcome Stephanie Moulton of the John Glenn School of Public Affairs, where she teaches courses in nonprofit and public management and researches the intersection between public, private, and nonprofit organizations. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ann, for having me.
First, can we talk about just what the universe of nonprofits is out there and how it operates generally?
Sure. So there's about 1.5 million registered nonprofit organizations that have registered with the Internal Revenue Service and file a Form 990, which is actually a lot larger than some people would think. And we actually estimate that number to be about 2.5 million if you include all of the churches and smaller nonprofit organizations that don't report to the IRS. So we actually have a pretty large nonprofit sector. 10% of the population, the working population, is employed in the nonprofit sector. So this is a pretty significant section of our economy. And one of the things that we often don't think about with nonprofit organizations, we think about them as being donor-driven organizations, that they rely a lot on private donations. But in fact, the funding picture for nonprofit organizations is much more complex than that. And they're not simply donor-driven organizations. In fact, donations make up a really small portion of the revenue for most nonprofit organizations. The statistics show us that about 12% of the revenue for nonprofit organizations on average come from donations. And now it depends on the type of nonprofit we're talking about as well. So I want to briefly just give a little background there.
Sure.
There's something called a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which is what most of us are familiar with. That's your charitable nonprofit organization. And about 60% of all nonprofits fall into that 501c3 category. What that means, so all nonprofit organizations are tax exempt, which means they don't pay federal income taxes on any revenue that they bring in. However, there's a segment, the charitable nonprofits, that also are able to receive donations. And those donations that they receive the donor can actually claim a tax deduction for the donation that they make. And only charitable nonprofits or 501c3s qualify for that special deductibility of contributions.
Okay.
So that's what really separates the 501c3 charities from the others. Typically, when we're talking about nonprofit organizations, we're thinking a lot about the charitable organizations that provide a lot of our basic services.
I was going to say, when you're talking about nonprofit,
yeah.
Are all nonprofits charitable?
No, actually not. So you have your membership organizations as well. Credit unions are also nonprofit organizations. Business leagues are nonprofit organizations.
So like the Grange?
Absolutely, sure. So you have your group of membership organizations that are also nonprofits that may be member-serving and not necessarily public-serving. We also have 501c4s, which are still public-serving nonprofit organizations, but they tend to engage a bit more in political activity. Some of the political activity requirements are relaxed for that group of organizations.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. So, for example, with 501c3 nonprofits, lobbying expenditures are generally limited to about 20%. So one of the misnomers is that nonprofit organizations can't engage in political activity, and that's actually false. Nonprofit organizations can and do engage in political activity, but it has to be an unsubstantial portion of their total expenditures.
And they have to report it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And it depends, again, there's different ways that nonprofits can elect to do that, but correct. You know, they have to keep track of, or they have to measure how much they're spending on lobbying, and that has to be an unsubstantial portion of their revenue if they're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. 501c4s are more relaxed in that area, so they're able to engage more actively in political activity than the 501c3s.
Is there a requirement with 501c3 organizations that they collect donations from the private sector?
That's a good point. So there's something called a public support test for nonprofit organizations that require that they show that they've had some form of public support. So if you only had one donor or one person that was contributing all the revenue to the nonprofit organization, they'd probably be a private foundation rather than a charitable organization. But no, there is no requirement that they receive donations funds in order to be a nonprofit organization. And in fact, like I said, the average is about 12% of revenue to nonprofit organizations is actually from donations. Now, for health organizations like hospitals, that's as low as 2% of their revenue actually comes from donations. But then arts and cultural organizations, so you think about your museums, your arts organizations, your theaters, about 43% of their revenue comes from donations. For the traditional human service organization, which is, what most of us think about.
Mental health organizations, that kind
of thing. Right. That's about 16% of their revenue comes from donations. So it really depends, again, on the type of activity that the organization is engaged in. But across the board, donations are not the primary source of revenue for nonprofits.
My guest is Stephanie Moulton of the John Glenn School of Public Affairs, where she teaches courses in nonprofit and public management. We're talking about nonprofits and what the impact is going to be on them this year and in coming years, what it already has been since the economic downturn that started in 2008. If you have a question or comment for Stephanie Moulton, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is there a nonprofit out there that you care about, that you're concerned about in the next coming, in the coming years, the coming months? Give us a call and tell us about that, 614-292-8513. So, has it always been this way, Stephanie, that there's been this average or this large dependence spread across many organizations at differing levels along the continuum on government funding?
Right. So really since the 1800s, and I think this is also a misnomer, nonprofit organizations have been partners with government really since the early, again, the beginning of our country. But in the 1960s, we saw this major increase in the partnership between government and nonprofit organizations, primarily because we've spent a lot more focus on providing public services through government. And the way to do that wasn't necessarily the government doing it themselves. It was through partnering with nonprofit organizations that they were able to achieve those outcomes that they were seeking. Most recent figures show that about 52% of the revenue that federal, state, and local governments receive for social services actually goes to nonprofit organizations. So more than half of the revenue that government is bringing in through tax dollars to fund social service programs actually goes to nonprofit organizations. So they're very much a partner with nonprofit organizations. We often call them partners in public service in implementing the programs on the ground. And so one-third of revenue to nonprofit organizations comes from the government sector rather than from individual donations. Fee income is actually the largest source of income to nonprofit organizations, which is often something that people don't realize, so charging fees for services. And again, this is something that's been going on for a while. This isn't a new trend. This is something that has been part of the nonprofit sector. Now, as revenue channels shift and as we see decreases in government funding to nonprofits, we will see some changes in the way that they go about raising revenue. But again, government is still a very pivotal portion of the revenue that nonprofits receive.
What is the philosophical backdrop for having government outsource to nonprofits like it is?
Yeah, so there's two reasons. One is really that services could actually be more effectively provided in many cases when they're provided by nonprofit organizations. So if you think about nonprofit organizations often are closer to the people on the ground. They're closer to the communities than a state agency might be or even a local agency may be. They also may have access to client populations or to the group that's trying to be served more so than government. They have relationships with these individuals. They have trust with the individuals. So they actually, from a geographic standpoint, simply are often the more appropriate.
More effective.
Exactly. And they also have more discretion. They tend to have a bit more flexibility. They're known for being innovative. Nonprofit organizations, unlike government, don't have to go through the budget cycle, don't have to go through legislators to get things approved.
But they do have to show effectiveness.
Sure.
Often unlike government.
Yeah, that's true. And it's different. So the effectiveness, there's a couple of different movements in the nonprofit sector, really since in the last 15 years, I would say, to demonstrate the effectiveness of the things that nonprofits are doing. Some of those through United Way, for example, has been pivotal in trying to really track the outcomes and the impact of the nonprofit sector. We also can look at foundations and donors themselves are becoming more involved in the activities that nonprofit organizations are doing, not just making the donation, but actually working with the organization to achieve the outcomes or to see that the outcomes have been achieved over time.
You'd like to, if you have a question or comment for our guest, Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We welcome your emails as well. You You can go to allsides@wosu.org for that. And David from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and thanks. Mm-hmm. My question was in regard to the policies you have in place to prevent individuals from abusing the system. I know you mentioned earlier how there was a number of people had to kind of vote on or agree with any kind of nonprofit. What keeps them from taking advantage of that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
So understanding the question, what are the policies in place to make sure that the programs nonprofits provide are in line with the public interest, I think?
I imagine the boards can't corrupt the system, can't personally benefit.
Sure. Okay. So there's something in the nonprofit sector called the non-distribution constraint, which basically says that any of the profits that are made by the nonprofit organization, any of the income, and so again, nonprofit organizations, they're called nonprofit, but they still make money. It's not that they're not making a profit, but the profit that they make cannot go back to any shareholder or board member directly. So they don't receive distributions the way a for-profit corporation might receive. So because of that non-distribution constraint, nonprofit organizations are sometimes viewed as more trustworthy because, again, and their motives are viewed as being different than those of for-profit organizations because the income that they receive from the activities that they undertake don't go back to the shareholders. There's also governance guidelines for nonprofit boards of directors, and I'm sure Alan Proctor will get into that a bit more when he comes on later in the show. But those governance responsibilities are very serious, and the board of directors is legally responsible for the affairs of the nonprofit organization, and that board is responsible for making sure that the things that go on in the organization, be they financial activities that take place, investments that are being made, are being done in a prudent manner. And again, that's the board's responsibility to oversee those things.
Several years ago, there was a big problem with, I think it was a treasurer of a big nonprofit in Central Ohio. I think it was, I don't want to say because I'm not sure, but point is, he had problems at another big nonprofit in another state, and they knew about it, and they just sort of passed him along. It kind of reminds
you
there are other parallels and other things, such as in teaching and in churches and things like that.
Absolutely.
Are there any safeguards in place now for nonprofits to keep nonprofits from just passing people along?
Sure. I mean, I think the IRS Form 990, which is the only regulatory tool right now at the federal level that oversees nonprofit organizations. Now, state attorneys generals are also very involved in varying extents, I guess, depending on the state, but in the nonprofit sector. But the IRS Form 990 now has been revised in 2008 and has been implemented incrementally. But it includes questions about board governance, trying to get at some of those types of issues, but it's not going to pick up on all of them. So a lot of it really does fall down to the training of the board of directors, the training of the organization personnel to know what they need to be watching for, what are their duties as board members. And I think a lot of that, again, particularly for smaller nonprofit organizations, they simply don't know what the responsibilities of those board members may be. So, and again, I think Alan will probably talk about that in greater detail here in the second segment. But.
All righty. Well, you've been listening to Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. Stephanie's going to stay with us this hour. If you have any questions or comments for her coming up, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if that is your preferred mode of communication. Coming up, Alan Proctor. He writes a regular column on nonprofit management for Columbus Business First. He'll be with us after this break, so stay with us on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher online at WOSU.org/allsides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. You can also find All Sides on Facebook and Twitter, subscribe to podcasts, and preview upcoming programs. Discover more about WOSU and All Sides with Ann Fisher at WOSU.org/allsides.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
40 degrees in downtown Columbus, rain off and on throughout the day today and a high of 48. More rain tonight, a low of 39 degrees. There's a slight chance of rain on Wednesday. We could see a little sunshine and a high of 54. All Signs with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, Stephanie Moulton. She's a professor with the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join that conversation. Joining us now, Alan Proctor. Alan has worked as a top executive for Harvard University, the City of New York, the New York State Financial Control Board, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. As founder of Alan Proctor Consulting, his focus is to help clients build a solid financial and strategic base for future growth. He writes a regular column on nonprofit management for Columbus Business First, and he is the author of the book More Than Just Money, Practical and Provocative Steps to Nonprofit Success. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
Alan, you focus on the people who run these nonprofits.
I do. One of the hardest things for nonprofits is they say, are we a business? Do we run like a business? And when people come onto boards of directors, they don't know if they can apply their daily tools that they use in their for-profit business or not. So we spend a lot of time working with boards to understand this issue, and the theme of what we do we call linking mission to money, because it is so hard. When you are told to run like a business, but you exist because there's something where no one can make money, you have a really big challenge.
Because the premise of business is profit.
The premise of business is profit. At the same time, a nonprofit is no different than a for-profit in the sense that if they weren't profitable, they'd go bankrupt. So what makes a nonprofit different is what it does with its profits. And that leads to many governance things. In the earlier segment, the question was raised on, well, how do you regulate nonprofits? Nonprofits are regulated. In fact, when we talk about nonprofits, we're really talking about 501c3s, charitable organizations. And in exchange for that tax exemption, they're subject to tons of rules and regulations. They're told that all contracts have to be arm's length. You can't give a contract to your brother at favorable terms. You can't pay your directors huge amounts of money. In fact, although we run into this every so often at very large and wealthy nonprofits, there's even a rule called private annulment. You can't pay people too much. What we spend a lot of time doing is working with boards to understand, how do you set strategy when you have to be profitable, but your most important thing you do loses money? Where in a for-profit, you just stop doing it. So that's the big challenge we're always working on. And the other thing that's really important for nonprofits is they now, as was mentioned in the earlier segment, are one of the largest providers of government services. This was the outsourcing movement. But in some ways, it's kind of gone too far, because there was a wonderful survey done by the Urban Institute of about 2,000 nonprofits, and I'll focus just on Ohio. We are the number 8th state of nonprofits having problems that the government doesn't pay them the full cost of providing services.
Meaning they're providing services and not getting compensated for those services.
To do a service for the government is to lose money.
Okay. When you say it's number 8th, do you mean 8th worst?
Of all the states they surveyed, the proportion of nonprofits who had this problem, Ohio, there were only 7 states where there are more nonprofits that had this problem.
Okay.
So if it costs $1 to provide a service, the government will only pay you 80 cents. What do you do? And what's happened in the previous set of government cuts is the nonprofits protected the citizenry from all of these service cuts. What did they do? And we found that in Ohio, they cut back the salaries and benefits of their employees. They reduced staff, and they ran down their cash so that only 17% of the nonprofits in Ohio actually reduced services when the government cut down their payments. And the problem that nonprofits face right now is they've run their cash down. They've cut their staff salaries to the bone. The citizenry, when we have more government cuts, it's not, oh, they're going to cut money to a nonprofit and what's the nonprofit going to do? It's the government finally is going to see that if you cut money, you're going to lose the services. Because what are the options nonprofits have? Well, the option they took before was, well, they'll subsidize the government. I'll do this service that the taxpayers don't want to pay a dollar for. I'll do it for 80 cents. Well, that's almost tapped out. Cash balances are really, really low. And it's very hard to get donors to give you unrestricted cash for your reserves. The second thing they could do is some of them can charge fees, because how the nonprofit business model works is you do some things for a profit so that you can support things at a loss. Mm-hmm. Actually, hospitals are the most common example. Hospitals lose money on their trauma centers in their emergency wards, and they lose money on obstetrics.
But
they make money on orthopedics and cardiology, and they use those profits so they continue to give charity care. All nonprofits that are successful have a similar model like that, though some can charge fees a little more successfully than others. One of the biggest, best examples in this town is the Columbus Zoo. They run a hotel. They run an amusement park. They run a golf course. They all make money, and they use that so they can do their conservation work. So some nonprofits will actually increase the fees for people who can pay to support it. The third channel that some nonprofits are taking is they're thinking of litigating. You can't cut this service. The people need it too much. Actually, that's going to the Supreme Court this fall, and the argument is that the nonprofits have no standing to sue.
But not every nonprofit is created equally. So tell me what hospitals are one kind. We absolutely need hospitals. Tell me about the case going to the U.S. Supreme Court. What service do they offer us?
Well, it's a suit about Medicaid. The nonprofits say, I'm providing services for these people who need health care. If you cut Medicaid, they will not get the health care they need. Therefore, we're going to sue you and say you must provide these services. But over 22 states have joined the countersuit that says you as a nonprofit have no standing to sue.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that Congress has not empowered private individuals to make choices of Medicaid services. So then the fourth option that nonprofits have is to just say no. If you're not going to pay me to provide this service, I won't do it. That's heart-wrenching for a nonprofit, because nonprofits, what makes them wonderful is they're driven by passion. They're driven by wanting to really do things the community needs that somehow the market economy can't do. And some nonprofits are actually doing this. And right now I'm spending a lot of time in retreats with nonprofits going through what are the things that are so essential that you're going to do it no matter what. But what are the things, you're a sinking ship, what are you going to throw overboard? Because you've got to stop doing something.
How often is it that the thing they have to throw overboard is the point of why they exist in the first place?
Well, that's the really hard charge. One of the really difficult decisions that was made by one nonprofit in town was for over 100 years, its main reason for being was providing residential services for youth who are having severe emotional problems. Well, the government doesn't want to pay for that anymore, and the donors don't want to support it anymore. And the reality was they did 10 other really good things, but if they kept doing residential services, they'd go bankrupt and have to stop doing everything. So it's the issue of choices, and that's why I use the phrase linking mission to money, is you have a boat full of services, and you have to stay afloat. You need some things that make money, and you can only support so many things that lose money. And actually, to go back to a statistic that Stephanie mentioned earlier, if you look at just 501c3s, the contributions as a share of their revenues have never been above 25%. Never. In 85, when times were great, in 91, when times were poor, in 97, when times were great, it never does that. So fundamentally, it's can you make enough money on some activities to be able to support what the community really wants? And sometimes the community doesn't want it anymore. And that's the same market test that a for-profit faces.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to join the conversation. If you have a question or comment for our guests, Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs, and also Alan Proctor. He's the author of a couple books, but one of them, More Than Just Money, Practical and Provocative Steps to Nonprofit Success. He consults and gives advice to nonprofits. And the reason why we're talking about all of this is because of the economic downturn. We want to know how nonprofits are likely to fare in coming months and years. 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment. And Elizabeth from Lancaster, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very specifically, can a nonprofit organization endorse an issue on the ballot? For example, can a historical organization endorse a county parks issue?
You mean like the County Historical Society?
Yes.
Okay.
The answer is absolutely yes. In fact, they're expected to. Part of their mission is to foster public issues. The only restriction that nonprofits face is influencing the election of officials. Absolutely, that would be part of their mission, and any nonprofit that isn't trying to influence legislation is not doing its job.
Okay. And then I have another question.
Okay.
Can Stephanie give, or Alan, a book source for the parameters of small nonprofits that's very readable?
Well, I'll have to give a pitch for my first book. We're coming out with a second edition in April. It's called Linking Mission to Money, and it's specifically designed to teach executive directors and board members how to run a nonprofit in an easy way. It's you can think of it as a finance book with only two tables.
Stephanie, do you have any ideas?
Sure. I would suggest also the Ohio Attorney General's Office has a charitable nonprofit section, and there's some tremendous resources that are available online there. And the IRS actually does a very nice job of providing some trainings to smaller nonprofit organizations regarding different activities. And with regard to political activity there, I'm not sure if the book you were thinking of was specifically related to political activity, but there are some good resources, and perhaps go ahead.
In general,
okay, yeah. So, yes, I would suggest also, in addition to Alan's book, the two online sources, the Ohio Attorney General's Office, and then as well the IRS. If you click on the nonprofit section of that, there's some resources there as well.
Thanks, Elizabeth from Lancaster. We have an email from Charlotte that's sort of related to the political issue. She writes, in the last presidential election, there were stories about nonprofits funneling money for quote-unquote issue ads from unknown donors. What kind of nonprofits were those organizations, and do they have any obligation to reveal the identity of their donors to the general public? If not, why? Anyone want to take a shot?
Do you want to take that?
Sure, I can take that. So the issue here, I think there was a Supreme Court case that said that corporations actually now are allowed to be more involved in the election of a person. So it's electioneering, what Alan was referring to. There's a difference between lobbying and advocating on behalf of a particular policy area and then advocating on behalf of a person. And the thing that's at stake here is the actual advocating on behalf of a particular candidate or electioneering. And that's actually funneling money or contributions or speaking on behalf of your nonprofit organization about a particular candidate. 501c3s are not allowed to engage in electioneering, but 501c4s are to some extent, and this is changing again with the new Supreme Court case ruling. And so the question is, do they have to disclose the names of the donors? Currently, no, although this is something that could change, and some nonprofit organizations are actually taking steps to go ahead and disclose some of those just out of transparency. Now, the IRS does need need to know the name of the donor. So the IRS does keep track of that. But for the general public, do they know the donors? No. And there's reasons for that. So when donors make a contribution to the nonprofit organization, they may not want their identity to be known. They may want to do that anonymously, and they have the right to do that. The question then becomes, though, when we're looking at political activity, traditionally political organizations, political action committees, for example, donors are known. That is disclosed if you're donating to a political action committee. But with the new changes, because of the Supreme Court ruling, there's this fuzzy line for these 501c4s. And so this is something that will probably be continue to be debated over the next couple of months and perhaps even years, is where is that line going to be drawn in terms of disclosing the donor for electioneering activities?
Alan, another possible debate is the relationship that religious organizations have mm-hmm. with the taxing sector of our government. They are right now, they're not taxed. There's been discussions about changing that. What do we know about that, and how could their status be changed? How might that work?
Well, churches really are one of the fuzziest areas of the law. They are their own category. They aren't a 501c3, but they are subject to the same limitations on influencing elections. The way a church should balance it is if you have one elected official talk at your public, you have to open it to other people in the same election. It's been a very difficult area in Ohio because we have had some churches that have been very, very politically active. And in fact, the IRS is investigating that because they have crossed a line. So the line is much harder to draw than it is for a typical 501c3.
Another issue I'd bring up, this is Stephanie, is related to the property taxes. Mm-hmm. So all nonprofit organizations are exempt from property taxes, but that is a local and state policy decision to exempt them from the property taxes. Unlike tax exemption for income, which is a federal issue, this is actually local and state governments. And so what we've seen, if you think about who owns property, large universities that are nonprofits own property. Churches and religious organizations often own property.
Hospitals
mm-hmm. own property. These are large amounts of property that are owned by nonprofit organizations that may not be taxed. And in fact, if they're a 501c3 or 501c4, if they're a nonprofit, they currently are exempt from taxes, property taxes on that property. Now, there are proposals in Pennsylvania, Florida, and I'm not sure if Ohio is considering this yet or not, but there are state and local governments that are considering payments in lieu of taxes. So they actually do collect some revenue off of that land. But again, this is something religious organizations often own property, smaller nonprofits. Profit organizations often own property. So is this something that's only going to affect the large universities, large hospitals that own quite a considerable amount of property, or is this something that would affect all organizations? And this is often debated at the state and local levels.
I think that's an important point. Payments in lieu of taxes are actually quite common in the university world.
Okay.
There are towns where almost 50% of their property tax base is exempt. And these payments in lieu of taxes are negotiated. They aren't mandatory. And they usually go towards the wealthier universities or institutions. And it's under a reasonable notion of, if you want us to provide police services, if you want us to provide fire services, it's only fair. And I say the real issue then is some local governments are indeed having financial problems because the exemption. Though it usually comes from a state law that governs what the localities can do.
Okay.
And I think it's important to understand that 501c3 is a federal designation, and states have complete option. They could even impose state income taxes if they wished, or sales taxes.
So these kinds of situations disproportionately affect, say, smaller towns where there's a big university, which there's a lot of that in Ohio.
You bet there is.
Right.
Yeah. We have to take another break. I want to say thank you to Alan Proctor. Thanks for joining us today, Alan.
Thank you very much. And if people have any other issues, we have a regular blog and our column on Business First. They're most welcome to use it for simple answers to complex issues.
All righty. Alan has worked a top executive at Harvard University, New York City, the New York State Financial Control Board, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And as he said, He writes a regular column on nonprofit management for Columbus Business First, and he's the author of the book, we talked about it today, More Than Just Money, Practical and Provocative Steps to Nonprofit Success. Returning after the break, Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs, and joining us, Nicole Edwards of the Edwards Group. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station, and on 89.7 NPR News, you can hear your favorite shows.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I'm Neil Conan, and this is Talk of the Nation.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, or streaming at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides begins. And following the devastating earthquake and tsunami, the Japanese authorities are trying to control damaged reactors. Hear about the steps being taken to handle the emergency. That discussion at 11 on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Support for 89.7 comes from Horizon Science and Noble Academies, providing college prep curriculum focusing on science and math. Information about Horizon and Noble Academies college acceptance rates is at horizoncolumbus.org.
It's currently 40 degrees in downtown Columbus. Expect rain off and on throughout the day and a high of 48. More rain tonight, a low of 39 degrees. There's a slight chance of morning rain on Wednesday and then a little sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 54. Clear skies Wednesday night, a low of 40 degrees. And looking ahead to Thursday, sunny skies and a high of 67. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Joining us now, Nicole Edwards. Nicole is with the She's a financial advisor with the Edwards Group. She joined her brother Brian Edwards at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney in January 1999 and is now with the Edwards Group with her brother Brian Edwards. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
You devote part of your work to nonprofit work. Tell us what somebody like you does with a nonprofit organization.
On our team, we really focus on a much smaller scale nonprofit, the $1 million to $15 million nonprofit. We found that those are probably the ones that have the most problems because they don't have the size and scope and the wherewithal to do in-house research and get all of the consulting help and everything that they need. Most of their boards are voluntary, and usually the only paid position is the executive director. So what we try to do is really go in and provide education to them, especially to the board, to make sure that they understand their roles, responsibilities, their legal responsibilities, their fiduciary responsibilities.
What do you find are some of the common, I'd hate to use the word mistakes, but let's, for lack of better words, just say mistakes that these levels of nonprofits make?
I think the biggest one, and it's always a number that's very surprising to us, is that they do not have a formal written investment policy statement. So we have maybe 34% of small foundations, nonprofits that maybe have one that's understood, but that's not actually formally written out and then reviewed on any type of annual basis.
Is there a requirement for that?
There should be. And technically, there really is with the adoption by the state of Ohio of MIFA in 2006.
And what is MIFA?
MIFA is actually a very specific law that's called the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. 48 states have adopted it, and Ohio is included in that. And basically what that did is it sort of enhanced the prudent man rule, which makes fiduciaries, so board members, trustees, liable for investment returns.
So they're liable for the returns, but they're not responsible for providing the sort of plan that would lead to those kinds of prudent returns.
Well, at the end of the day, because they are answerable to the state attorney general or to the IRS, it's very much so recommended, and we really provide a checklist to nonprofits saying you need to document what you're doing. You need to have a written investment policy statement. You need to have a tactical asset allocation that could have seen you through maybe the really bad markets in 08 and part of 09. You need to have a strategic or long-term asset allocation strategy. And oftentimes, what we've recommend is, and what we see is that there's a finance committee or an investment committee within the board who have the people on that are sophisticated enough to understand that portfolio management maybe can't be done in-house, and that, in fact, it's almost mandated that they hire professionals to do it for them.
How often does the makeup of a board affect those kinds of decisions?
Well, oftentimes it seems that the boards sort of turn over at least some of the functions on committees on a three-year timetable. If you have written investment policy statements and you have reference material for incoming members, board members, to follow, the transition can be much smoother than if you actually have an investment policy partner, an investment partner who has walked different boards through, and sometimes even different executive directors through what the long-term focus is, it becomes a much smoother transition.
Some nonprofits, particularly smaller ones, less experienced ones perhaps, but be that as it may, with less cash reserves, are going to say, we can't afford to hire a professional because we're responsible for spending that money on X, Y, and Z. We talked earlier about restrictions.
Well, you know, they almost, to some regard, have to, because what's happened is, historically, you were able to buy U.S. Treasury bonds and CDs and keep the money safe and say, I've done what we need to do. We've protected the principal. The new laws that have basically been written has said, for the most part, that risk almost has to be taken. So you can't just sit on, especially right now, if you had a bond portfolio or a CD portfolio, you were just, all of our money is principal guaranteed. This is one of the few times in history that we absolutely know that inflation is coming, and we know that the Fed has to raise rates at some point. When that happens, as an example, a 3% bond portfolio with a duration of 4.5 years is going to lose, if rates go up 2 basis points, it could lose almost 10% of its value in 1 year. It's still going to have a negative 3-year return, and on a 5-year return, you're still going to be in, you know, single digits. What boards have to realize, and I think this is much more the responsibility of the investment committee than to teach the board, is that you have to look at a total return picture. So it's not just about getting my 4% or 3.5%, but you also have to look at, there is a spending cost. So there is a cost to having a financial partner. But then what a lot of small foundations and nonprofits miss is that there's an inflation factor. So at the end of the day, right now we've had pretty nominal inflation, but if it's historically 3%, you're looking at needing an 8% total return objective. What in the last 1, 3, 5, 10 years has gotten 8%? And, you know, even the large endowments who have the flexibility to have a lot more illiquidity, which got them in trouble too, but have alternative exposure, have shown that over time on a 5-10 year number, because, again, some of this money is for long term. It's not just for the next 3 years out. What you really have to do is have asset allocation that evaluates risk return of the total portfolio and not just one asset class at a time. So we've seen a lot of fear of owning alternatives because that's just a word that maybe until really 2006 there were some some IPS statements, and then we still have some that just say this is a banned holding. We can't hedge, we can't have futures, we can't have derivatives. And what we found is that a 60-40 portfolio, traditionally 60% equity and 40% fixed income, is not on any time frame going to meet that 8% total return. So how do you get there? You get there by having a much more sophisticated asset allocation. And in the small foundation world, it's very hard for them to do themselves.
We're talking about the economic downturn and its impact on nonprofits. Our guests, Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs, and also with us and speaking just now, Nicole Edwards, she's a financial advisor with the Edwards Group. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, some nonprofits can be very aggressive. In fact, some of them went with Bernie Madoff, you know, the infamous Ponzi scheme debacle, the man behind the debacle. They lost everything. How do you advise nonprofits to go about it? So they thought they were doing the right thing. They were making money hand over fist for a while, doing really well. What's the ultimate responsibility?
The ultimate responsibility is to basically have a formalized strategy for selecting and evaluating investment managers, mutual funds, and consultants. So if the numbers are too good to be true, they are. And I think that that's the story from Madoff and from many other, scams, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. I think that you have to, you know, the beauty, at least at what we do at Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, is we have the consulting group, which is really the premier money management arm of was Smith Barney, started back in the EF Hutton days in 1973. And really, we have an entire level of research that looks at the 8,000-plus managers that are available and narrows them down. So consistency of performance. How long have their portfolio managers been in place? What type of professional turnover do they have? Can they sustain their business model? And when you have all that and can put together managers that almost have had an extra level of policing before you even look at them as an option to offer to the boards as a potential large cap manager or small cap manager or international manager, you know that you have provided them really, or the lack of risk in terms of them having doing their own research, because it's not always the hot dot manager that's the best manager, or it's not always putting six hot dot managers together saying, well, I've got six good managers. Well, what have you really built in terms of portfolio, and what type of risk is in that portfolio that you really haven't evaluated?
614-292-8513. We have a few more minutes left with our guest, Nicole Edwards, and also Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. Nicole, there's two issues now. You're saying that almost certainly, and you look to our other guests for nods of agreement, that the inflation is on its way. And also, we talked earlier about the inevitable, probably for many nonprofits, government cutbacks. How are you advising them when the flow of the cash, the influx of money is changing, and the amount that they need to have in reserves is increasing, or that they should have in reserves?
Our approach has always been to really have at least two funds. One is a short-term cash management fund. These are operating expenses for the next 2 years, so that the board and everybody is very comfortable knowing we can meet whatever challenges are short term. And then the second one is to basically have an investment fund, the true asset allocation that is expected to sort of go on in perpetuity. And they understand that that's longer term, and that they can have that risk return look without them panicking about, oh my goodness, internationally has done horrible, or emerging markets has really started out the year weakly, or what about what about commodities? Should we even have some exposure? And so when you really set up the two silos, it's very easy to manage the equity and alternative investment portfolio aside from the short-term cash needs.
I know that you don't advise these big, the big universities, but there was an article in the paper today there's a lawmaker, state lawmaker, who's critical of the university's purchasing property right now during the downturn. That's not a good use of their money. Just in general, those kinds of capital expenditures, capital improvements for that matter, may seem not superfluous, but unnecessary at this point.
You know, it's hard for whatever a person looks at. Each nonprofit sort of functions in its own, with its own mission, and for anyone to look and say and sort of paint the picture and say this is inappropriate, you might want to find out why, in fact, they're doing something. Illiquidity was a huge issue the past few years. So if they're buying property, they have to know that that's part of the portfolio that is really illiquid. But that may, because they're getting prices cheaper than they probably would have in years, that may be a very appropriate investment for that specific university or nonprofit. On the other side, you really have to let. You know, if they have a specific question, they should ask it. You really can't just say it's not appropriate for everybody, because there are large endowments in universities that can take a much larger illiquid position, that own timber, that own very real hard assets, but they generate much more than 4 or 5% of the endowment. Their spending level is much higher, so they're looking for return from many different areas. And that would probably be the case of any large university or institution. Whereas in the smaller world, where you really are relying on individual donations and your much smaller assets to generate maybe 4 or 5%, you probably aren't going to take those same risks.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Nicole Edwards of the Edwards Financial Group with Morgan Stanley Smith Barney. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And also Stephanie Moulton of the OSU John Glenn School of Public Affairs. Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ann.
And Alan Proctor, once again, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
That is all the time we have on All Sides. Thanks for listening today. I'm sure that this is an ongoing conversation about nonprofits and how they survive the economic downturn. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.